Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
You're back.
That was spooky. Okay.
Spooky, scary skeletons and shivers down my spine.
All right, I'm going to mute myself.
Oh, tonight we got them. Goldie the Sulk and JC.
Disgusting.
And it starts right now.
So we're back. Welcome to another episode of A Typical Disgusting Display, a podcast for writers by writers who hate writing. And Goldie, we were texting this week, and you had just a lovely day at the Magic Kingdom with your family. So what were some of the highlights there?
So everyone goes to Disneyland, right? And their mentality is like, I'm here, I shouldn't have to wait for anything.
Right. Yeah.
Because you pay, and then everyone goes in and they're like, I want to go to Disneyland. I want to have fun. And something I read a while ago, I don't know if it's true, but the park is basically constantly at 10 times the capacity that Walt Disney ever anticipated.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because when it was originally built, he said, well, this is for children, and surely no adult will have any interest in this. So the only thing we'll ever have to worry about is people bringing their children. But instead, it's just flooded with adults who come in the park, and then we all kind of say, well, I'll pay extra to get in front of all these other people. But because so many people are doing that, they just charge you, and there's this thing called Genie Pass where they kind of con you into saying, like, you can book this ride. You basically get two extra rides. You basically sort of in a day can book one thing for 3 hours from now and not wait as long. And then a second thing 3 hours from now. Okay. Anyway, point is, we all know that we're going to be in lines. It's fine.
Regardless. So,
but when you're in line, you really have a chance to study the people you're in line with and make line enemies for no reason, simply because of proximity. And this could be just because, of course, if anyone coughs at all now, you just decide internally, like, this is the worst person on the face of the earth. They are risking public health, which is something you gave no thought to. Unless you're the one who's coughing, and then you're like, I'm fine. I just have this little cough. Right?
It's their cough.
Yeah, so it's their cough. And then, you know, there are people who are geared up for Disney like a sporting event, which I am not one of these people. Right. But it's interesting because you're not allowed to dress as a character, because then you would blend in with the cast members who are also dressed as a character. But you're kind of allowed to dress as a character.
That's weird.
But there are people who are, you know, wearing ears. And then one line of T-shirt, which is probably my least favorite, is the they say, I'm done adulting.
Oh, God.
And I just try to picture the reaction of my deceased father.
Oh, no.
Guadalcanal.
Yes.
Witnessing someone who has not experienced combat at an amusement park who's declaring to the world that they are done adulting. They're just going to act like a child. Even though they're escorting a child.
So first joke of the day.
You're not a child. You can't be done adulting. That's just a ridiculous thing to declare. And so how are we ever going to win whatever, you know, contest we're in with China and the rest of the world? Like, done adulting over there?
No.
They're adulting constantly. All the time. And without a break.
They adult from age 5 over there.
Yeah, they're adulting. The rest of the world is going to adult. So for us to decide we're just taking a break from adulting, it's a little dangerous.
Right.
So there's that. But then the one that just has stuck in my head since I saw it, and I'm curious to get your reaction because it's something we've talked about on the podcast, is there's a guy wearing a cap for Cologuard. He's just decided when I mailed my shit in to these people to learn whether or not I had colon cancer, it went so well that I just want to tell the world I'm just a fan of this medical test where you shit in a box and pay $400 and they diagnose you with polyps. What is it? What?
You don't think
you may like it. I like it. I do it. I'm not geared up.
Oh my God.
I'm not done adulting and proudly declaring my allegiance to a shit turd
test.
Yes. To a turd exam.
Well, first of all, this brings up a couple things right away. First of all, my dad will wear any free clothing that's sent to him.
Yep.
Okay,
so there's
perfect.
That. But then that does not line up because my dad also would never give a shit or go to Disneyland.
Right.
So the mixture of the person who wears free clothes with the expensive day at Disney does not line up.
Okay.
I agree.
Yes.
So now was the Cologuard hat, was it a trucker hat? Like what can you
know
the hat?
It looked like sort of a Patagonia baseball cap.
Oh,
you know,
like
when you see like an unbranded nylon baseball
yes.
cap.
Yes.
But
oh.
it just said Cologuard on it. And to me it reminded me of when you go on vacation.
So the cap was meshy.
Yeah, like yeah. You go on vacation.
Lionel Messi.
And there are just people who are just basic bitches and they're wearing a branded polo shirt for the hotel where you're staying, but they
yes.
don't work for the hotel. And you say, okay, this might be okay for one day because you forgot a shirt. Although certainly just go to a local Target, whatever, and buy some Hanes t-shirts, which is
right.
what
yeah.
I've done when I've forgotten my clothes. But they're just kind of going like Marriott.
Yeah.
And you go, you're at a Marriott.
Yeah.
It's fine. There are better things. There are worse things. But like you don't, there's no benefit to this. Like you can get a shirt that doesn't say Marriott and just have no opinion.
Right.
So the Cologuard thing to me is you go, I mean, no matter how free it was, like you could also take a, you know, a piece of newspaper and make a pirate hat.
Well, also, I mean, did you consider, so I'm assuming you did not speak to this gentleman.
No, I was not looking to engage.
Oh,
okay, see, because it would have been nice to hear if, you know, maybe he was a listener of the podcast and he had heard me talking about it. And so that's why he was wearing
my
hat.
God.
But you know
no.
what? We'll do that research next time. See how far my reach is as colon ambassador. I put the ass in ambassador.
Yeah. Although while you're getting a colonoscopy, I think it would be permissible to wear a I'm done adulting t-shirt.
And the Cologuard hat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's if I go in, that's what I'm wearing.
Yes. We gotta get you one of those.
I'm gonna wear an I'm done adulting shirt.
we could probably get those Cologuard hats just for all of us here.
What a funny picture to be under anesthesia with a tube up your ass and an I'm done adulting t-shirt. I really want that to be my acting headshot.
It's better than Kirker's. Well, that sounds like a fun day with family.
I mean, look. You can say whatever you want about Disneyland. Your kids will always leave saying they had the greatest day of their life,
that's
which
sweet.
Is
that's
the only thing that matters.
Yes, that's what Uncle Walt wanted.
Yeah.
Before we've got Danny Ricker here today from the Kimmel Show. But before we get to him, I just wanted to speak briefly about something that I texted both of you about, and I posted it on Instagram. You know, on this podcast, I kind of enjoy my role between me and Goldie. Like, I'm the happier one. Like, I have like a, you know, I have a lightness to me where Goldie comes on and he's hysterical, railing about this happened and that happened and I'm bald and it's not fair. And so I sort of get to float around that and add little puns and all that kind of stuff. So I'm like the Memphis Belle, right? Like, okay. I'm kind of somehow just cruising through the flack.
Just for time reasons, I'm not going to dispute this, but know that I'm going to protest with the commissioner tomorrow.
That's understandable. Good luck with that. Good luck with that. The commissioner's in my pocket. But so I'm floating through the flack, the Memphis Belle,
right.
Okay. Mission after mission. It's coming back safe, back to the base in England. And then one day, your daughter is searching on the internet and she's just looking up words. You know how we used to do that in real dictionaries just for fun, like looking up words and fun definitions. So she comes running in to where my wife and I are watching TV, saying that she had just looked up my name, Alec, looked it up on the internet. What does Alec mean, according to the Oxford English Dictionary? It means a stupid person. That's really what it means. And there was the sentence afterwards is, what kind of an Alec do you take me for? And so I'd never heard it either. I'd gone through my whole life never hearing that. Because I'm an Alec.
Yeah, you're ignorant.
Yeah, you don't know. I don't learn. So Levy is now Levy has gotten to the point where she will just be laughing and she'll say to me, Dada, do you know what I'm thinking about? I said, my name. And she said, yes. Like, that's the new thing around the house. And of course, Tal means like queen and morning dew and like the Hebraic, you know, this vaunted woman, all this kind of stuff. And mine is stupid person. So sadly, the Memphis Belle, the right wing has been shredded off. Last contact was over the English Channel, and the notifications are being sent to the parents of everyone on board. I took a direct hit.
Well, I'm happy to learn this.
I know you are. I know what joy it brings you, and it's
good news.
Screwing up our podcast dynamic, where again you're the grump and I'm just like the sprightly elf dancing through the forest.
Yeah, I mean, you're this Alec who doesn't really know what's going on in the world.
Stop using it. Stop applying it.
You know, you've got this very facile sort of Alec outlook toward everything.
He used it again.
I'm tormented by, you know, my reading and my analysis of stuff. But as an Alec, you don't participate in those activities.
That's true. And I guess looking at the Khan College ranking in this year's college guide, an Alec might fit pretty well. All right. So that was my...
That's all I've been saying. I
know. Week after week. So shitty week for me and the Memphis Belle. But very fun. I'm glad Levy is getting a kick out of it.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So now, for those of you who've listened to the podcast in the past, we have lots of different writers on here, and some of them, very few,
step forward and say, I want to do Johnny jokes with you guys. These people are heroes. The other people are cowards. And today, folks, friends, we have ourselves a hero. We have Danny Ricker from The Kimmel Show, who is joining us today. And he said, I want to do Johnny jokes.
From Hollywood, here's Jimmy's Johnny.
Oh, all right. And Danny, we offer this choice to all of our guests. Is there an order in which you would like to go?
Just in case I've made a huge mistake, I'd like to go first, if that's okay.
Very smart. Yes, it is.
All right. Very smart. Go ahead, Johnny One, take it away.
All right. I should have practiced the voice before I got on
here.
Thank you. At a recent auction, Harrison Ford's whip from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom sold for $525,000.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. No word yet if the buyer was a fan or just a rich pervert.
Yes.
On the board.
Thank you.
My money's on pervert.
Yeah. Former President Donald Trump won not one but two tournaments at the Trump International Golf Club this weekend. He hasn't been that excited on a golf course since he buried Ivana. Adult film star Stormy Daniels will be allowed to testify in Donald Trump's upcoming hush money trial. Yeah, that's going to cause some confusion in the court, though, because when they ask her if she's willing to tell the whole truth, she'll say, sure, but which hole?
Oh, well done.
Thank you.
Look at you.
Yes.
A hero.
Oscar worthy.
First day in Vietnam and he's in the
shoot. I love it.
All right. Here we go. Maybe you heard about this. Bruce Hornsby had to cancel several upcoming shows due to soreness in his hands. Well, when you play piano, that's just the way it is.
Oh, that's just the way it is.
An alarming new study shows that more and more teenage girls are suffering with reproductive disorders. Because they are technically still children, doctors will be telling them that they have supercalifragilistic endometriosis.
Oh, wow.
So proud of yourself.
that's my wheelhouse. Well, finally, I have somebody to laugh at me. Thank you, Danny. After a prolonged and sometimes suspicious absence, Princess Kate delivered a video message in which she revealed that she has cancer.
Yeah.
Not sure she helped her cause too much when she claimed it was testicular.
Oh.
God. Testicular.
Is that a pun or you're just saying she has no balls?
Yeah, I'm saying maybe it's not real because she said she had testicular cancer.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
I thought you were getting into it with the setup and then you did.
Can we use the silence as an asset for next week? Because that was quite impressive. Okay, back to the silly ones.
I thought you were going to say she had supercalifragilistic tumor or something.
Yeah, that would have been good. I should have just done that twice. It would have been way better. Okay, Oscar Mayer. Heard of them? Oscar Mayer was forced to recall some of its lean bacon because the meat did not have enough fat to sizzle properly. Sounds like the work of Ozempig. Ozempig.
I like it.
And finally.
Six? How many?
Feels like eight, but it's actually five.
Okay.
Here we go. Shohei Ohtani. Shohei Ohtani held a press conference to deny that he has a gambling problem. Seems like he threw a teammate under the bus, however, when he added, Shohei plays Mookie Betts.
Oh.
Yeah.
Johnny Three. Boy, what a.
Okay.
What a mélange that was.
Let me just sweep the plate here.
Oh, no.
Try to get back on track. Boeing. Boeing has fired their CEO and top executive board. Boeing says they're ready to completely rebuild the company if they can just find a few loose bolts that were here a second ago.
Boeing gone.
China is threatening war after learning there are U.S. troops stationed at the Taiwanese border. Hey, at least we're defending a border somewhere.
Oh. No.
The U.S. government may soon ban TikTok.
Ooh.
Yeah, the move could leave tens of millions of people with nothing to watch while driving. And finally, Donald Trump. Yep. Donald Trump is having trouble securing a $175 million bond to pay a court-ordered settlement for defrauding lenders. Trump says he's confident he'll be able to obtain the bond as soon as he's able to defraud more lenders.
Yes. Great job, guys.
We done it. We done it. All right. So you have the soft intro.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Now time for the bigger intro for our guest today, who is Danny Ricker, co-head writer of The Late Show with Jimmy. Is it The Late Show with Jimmy Kimmel? What's it called?
No, it's Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Jimmy Kimmel Live. I should know that by now. You'd think I would know that by now.
Everyone calls every late night show late night, by the way, though. So it's all right. Late night is Seth Meyers' show, but that's the 99% of people call every late night show late night. So
Jimmy Kimmel Live. I know that. I know that.
God.
But yes. Yeah, so Danny Ricker is here. He's been working on the show for a very long time, and he's been with Jimmy through all of his big awards appearances, a White House Correspondents' Dinner, the Emmys, the Oscars. So we'll talk about all of that. So please welcome friends, Mr. Danny Ricker. Danny, ooh, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I just want to say I you guys are my favorite podcast, no joke. Aww. And I'm really excited to be here. And if I could, I'd like to tell a quick story about my booking on this podcast, if that's all right.
Please.
So I met Goldie during the strike on the picket line, and I met him through our common friend, Jesse Joyce, who's a great guy, fantastic writer. And I was very excited to meet Goldie. Like, I mean, you know, I've been listening to you guys since you started. And so, you know, I got to like do a bunch of laps around the Disney lot with Goldie. I was very excited. And we had a nice talk. And at the end of the talk, Goldie goes, hey, you should come on the podcast sometime. And I think that's very nice of Goldie to say. I'm sure he doesn't really mean that, but like, hey, that's nice. And then lo and behold, a few weeks ago, I get a text from Goldie on a Sunday night saying, hey, do you want to come on? And I go, I'm super flattered, you know, and I'm like going to bed that night telling my wife, like, wow, out of all the like writers and producers and directors and actors they could have on this show, they want me to come on. And I'm really honored for about 12 hours. Until Monday morning when a new episode of the show comes out, and it starts with a lengthy preamble from you guys about how you're going to be reviewing an old episode of The Sopranos because, to use Goldie's words, you have had a, quote, lull in bookings and, a, quote, run out of guests. And, you know, it's nice, you know, you usually feel like you're at the bottom of the barrel in show business, but it's nice to have it confirmed every once in a while.
No, we had to reach back up to the top. We said, yes, let's reach for the stars again like we used to.
Well, all joking aside, I'm very, very happy to be here and very excited to talk to you guys. So thank
you. Well, the lull continues, you know.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. I remember that show. I remember when Goldie said those things.
People actually You know, then we always get emails. We like it when you guys do this. You know, like we really struggle to, I mean, to get guests, to get someone to come on. Obviously, there's a lot of coordination to go on. And then, you know, someone like you is very busy because you have a big, important job. And these, to me, are the episodes where you go, oh, this is an opportunity to actually learn something and for the audience to get access, which is what people always say they want.
Yes.
And what I find interesting is, how does someone get their job? How does someone keep their job? What is someone's day to day like? But then we do something where we're like, you know, let's just watch an episode and not put nothing into it. People are like, finally, like, so much. It's so like, you know, it's like finding out you made someone a Thanksgiving dinner and them going like, I love that bag of Doritos you gave. Like, okay, I give up. I don't care.
I told Goldie this when I met him, though. You guys have such practical advice on this show. And whether you're talking to someone or it's just something from your guys' experience, hearing you guys talk about old episodes of TV actually is, for me, very educational, because I go, you know, I'm a late night writer, but I'm, you know, interested in narrative and sitcom, and so hearing you guys who have worked in it for so long actually break it down is super interesting. So you know, as a fan, I like them all, I will say.
All right, that's, well, cool. So get out of here. Let's talk about Seinfeld the Buffy shirt. Let's go. So Danny, in reading about you, I forget where, whether it was the internet or a file you sent.
So kindly.
You grew up here in Southern California, is that right?
I did. And by the way, just to defend myself with, I did send some information over ahead of time. And I just yeah. And I just want to say,
nice.
The reason I did that, again, not to harp on this, I am a fan of the show. And I was putting myself in Alex's shoes, because I go, I know, like 10 minutes before the show starts, he's going to crack his knuckles and log on to Wikipedia. And
then wait a minute.
That there's no Wikipedia page for this person, and he's going to panic. And I didn't want that to happen. So I put a couple bullet points just for, you know.
It was incredibly helpful, yeah. By the way. I do appreciate
I think
that.
So thoughtful.
Is there a camera in here? How do you know my process? And it's more like 15 to 20 minutes before the show, by the way. I give myself a little pad. So growing up now, when you say Southern California, is that LA? Is that Orange County? Where were you?
Yeah, Orange County, which is, you know, like a suburb of Los Angeles for those who don't live here. And it was like almost no one I knew was in show business. So it was kind of like that wasn't even anything that was really on the radar. I mean, I think we had like one kid at our high school who was in like a you know, like a cell phone commercial or something, and he was like Tom Cruise of our high school. I mean, that was kind of like, you know. And
is it all just tennis pros? Is that what they're doing down there?
And surfers.
There's kind of two versions of Orange County, and I kind of lived in both of them. Like I lived right by Disneyland, actually, and when I was a kid. And by the way, Goldie, I will say, I think the worst t-shirts at Disneyland are the His and Hers shirts they do. like the Beauty and Beast ones. Which seems like always came from a fight at home, like, you know, like no way the boyfriend wanted to wear it. But
there's a lot of people who clearly are like, oh no,
like they're relying on that trip to Disneyland to save their marriage.
Yeah, you're right. There's a distinct vibe of guys who've lost fights.
So you know, I did improv in high school and stuff like that, and I moved up to LA to go to college. And again, I was never even really thinking of getting into show business, but at my college, I went to UCLA, and they had a sketch show called the Mike and Ben Show that ran. It was a TV show, and it ran closed circuit on channel 29 in the dorms, and there were only two shows on that channel. It was the Mike and Ben Show and something called Bruin News, which was a news show they would tape like a week late. So it was like people reading, kids reading old news, and there was only one episode a week.
It's like this podcast.
Yeah, totally.
And then it was Mike and Ben, which was completely uncensored. There was no oversight from the university whatsoever. I was eventually like in charge of the show, and I would get dragged into like the university heads like a couple of times a year to like defend us for like, like they, it would be running on like in the student union while there's, you know, like a bunch of prospective students getting a tour. And in the student union, on all the screens, there's like a sketch we'd filmed with like simulated oral sex going on. And, and so they'd be like, hey, just don't run that stuff, but, you know, before like 11 a.m. or whatever. It's like, okay. But I got interested in kind of television during that time.
Year on this? Just
this was like 2003 to 2006.
Okay.
Okay.
And then I was really, I actually grew up listening to Jimmy on the radio out here in Los Angeles, you know, cause he was on, he was on the Kevin and Bean show here on K-Rock, which I found at way too early an age. I mean, my parents got me a clock radio for Christmas when I was in like the fifth grade, and I was just sort of tuning around, and I found Kevin and Bean, which were, you know, if you don't know, they were like a morning drive time duo, but they were like much better than your,
yes,
your, you know, image of that. They were super funny and edgy and smart. And Jimmy was a huge part of that. He was their sports guy, but he wrote a lot of the sketches and he was in a lot of the stuff. And so, you know, like when I was, how old are you in the fifth grade? Like 11, you know, I mean, I was listening to these guys every day and hearing Jimmy every day. And so in this weird kind of dovetail, full circle kind of thing, I think my sense of humor lines up really well with his. He was a big influence on me as a literal child, you know,
yeah.
And then now we work together. Yeah. So.
Did you also listen to Loveline and Tom Likas and those other sort of
all of those
radio staples in LA? Because when I got out here, I somehow, and I didn't like him, but I wound up listening to Tom Likas every friggin' night.
Same for me. And I would like, I have a distinct, like a core memory of, remember listening to Loveline, hearing the word orgasm, not knowing what that was, and then pulling the dictionary, much like Levy did with your name. I pulled the dictionary and I looked up the word orgasm in the dictionary. Like that was before internet pornography. So that,
well, you know, pulling a dictionary can give you an orgasm. Yeah.
So that's, it literally did.
There.
Oh boy, he's back. The Ozempic is back. Testicular. I should let Danny say that so he can reference the earlier part of the show.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so you answered a lot of the questions we usually ask up here, which is what are the things you were laughing at when you were a kid? But so clearly you got this clock radio and that was a big thing for you.
Yeah,
it's interesting because we've talked to different people who, you know, they say, oh, I used to watch Saturday Night Live, or I watched the Carol Burnett Show, or whatever it was that made them laugh growing up. But for you, that was radio, which is crazy because you're younger than we are by about 10 years.
Yeah, like a decade.
And the radio seems like it was already on its way out when you were starting to listen to it.
Yeah. And you know, I had all the classic stuff too, SNL and The Simpsons and... you know, I remember somehow I had a recording of it was a monologue Steve Martin had done on SNL. It wasn't like the opening monologue. He did it like mid show. It was a Christmas show. And it was like Steve Martin's holiday wish. I don't know if you guys remember. It was like not even really that famous of a thing. But, he, you know, it's him going like, you know, if I had one wish this holiday season, it'd be for all the children of the world to join hands and sing in the spirit of harmony and peace. If I had two wishes, the first, of course, would be the kids, and the second would be $1 million a month. It's a great monologue.
I remember that.
And I remember I had a recording of it, and I sat at my desk in my room, and I wrote it out word for word. And I don't know why. Like, I was not interested in comedy, but I at that point, but it just the structure of that bit was like really like interesting to me. And I remember like. You know, as I've looked back on my, you know, my youth and what got me into comedy, I go, I don't know, maybe like the seeing that something could be funny with like a structure like that, that was kind of intentional, was interesting. And and really where I got interested in late night was Comedy Central at some point. Like I was too late to stay up to watch late night shows, but Comedy Central started running the previous night's late night with Conan O'Brien like the next afternoon. So I would like come home from school and watch Conan. Which that for me was like a big thing because I, you know, I got to like see like, oh, there are these people in these sketches. I think those are his writers. And even now I've gotten to like know some of those guys casually. Like you guys know Dan Cronin, right?
Oh, yeah. We love Dan Cronin. Yeah.
I did.
Dan Cronin's one of my neighbors. And like I was like over at his house recently and I was like going like, I need to play this cool because like I'm really excited. I'm at Dan Cronin's house. Like,
you know,
so those for me were like titans of comedy, like Brian Stack and, you know, all those guys that like did that show.
Yeah.
So I think like between that and Kevin and Bean, I kind of got this like this love of like the short form daily comedy, you know, and the grind of that and how it's kind of like its own art form, you know, it's disposable, but being able to do it every day is kind of the trick of it, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And by the way, next time you run into Cronin, just
lead with some Steely Dan facts. That's his big thing.
That's his thing.
That's his Achilles heel. He'll talk to you for 2 hours about that. So how were your parents in this equation? Like, did they expect you to go to UCLA and come out like an engineer? Like, did they have plans for your future that you then fucked up by going into comedy?
No, they were like shockingly supportive. And I'm not saying like it was shocking they were supportive, but I think most people would tell their parents like, oh, yeah, I want to be a comedian. And they'd say like, no, you know, don't do that.
Only child?
No, I'm one of three. I'm the oldest. Okay. And no, I just think
okay,
like.
Okay, so they'd given up on you.
Yeah. All the expectations rolled down.
Yeah, they were like, one of these kids is going to pan out and it's probably not going to be this one.
So. Yeah, so you can do whatever you want.
And when I was going to school, I went to UCLA to, I was going to be a teacher. I wanted to be a psychology teacher. And that was like what I was going to do. So I was studying psychology, which I like. So I think my parents felt like there was a backup plan. But I had a theater teacher, like my old high school theater teacher, who I remember having some conversation with her. I'm like, well, yeah, you know, no one makes a living in comedy. So like, I'm not going to do that. And she was like, well, like, you know, you're 19. You should maybe try a little bit, you know, and then
nice.
If it doesn't work out, you can, you know, do whatever else. So, so I just went like, all right, I guess I'll just try to do that for a little bit. And it just sort of eventually happened, you know?
Well, you know, awesome. What's interesting is because you said earlier that you had no intention of, getting into comedy at an early age. And yet I've heard you mention a couple things, like you were in this improv troupe in college and you worked on the television show and you were your drama teacher. So you had some inkling or something inside of you that wanted to perform. Is that right? I mean, when did you start feeling that?
Yeah. And probably my freshman year in high school and I, you know, started doing improv. It was like I'd not been good at anything up to that point. I was like no athletic ability, no music ability, you know, anything. And the first time I kind of got in and did something like that, I went like, oh, OK, it's like that. I don't know. I think we all have felt it in our own, you know, in our own ways where something clicks.
Never.
And you go, yeah. But you at least go, I fit more into this than anything, even if it's not the perfect thing.
But. Goldie's the no and improv school of John Goldblatt.
Never for a second have I been doing this or on stage and felt anything other than like, I just need this to be over. It's going terrible.
Well, and that's how I started to feel as a performer. You know, I did improv and it was fine. And I was never like fantastic at that. I was always like fine, you know, and like, the few times I tried stand up, it was like, fine. You know, I kind of came to feel like I'm like, I will never be a great performer. You know,
were
like,
you doing dramatic anything, any like Neil Simon scenes or all the standard acting school fare?
A little. I mean, just in high school, I actually met my wife. We played husband and wife in a high school play. So I did a little of like that, you know, but
role a little too seriously.
Yeah. I did a little bit of that, but nothing like seriously as an adult. And I just started to like, as I was performing, I was also writing. I was like, I think I might be slightly better at this. And maybe it's better to like pour my efforts into that instead of being like just the most mediocre stand up until I die or whatever.
I always attributed that to people wanted to hear what I had to say, but didn't want to have to look at me while I said it.
No way.
Yep. I had a similar feeling for sure. It's interesting because we talk to a lot of writers, obviously, on here. And I think, you know, there are these similarities between the writers where they do. I did it. Goldie did it. You did it. Where you start off performing, you know, you... And for me and Goldie, I won't speak for you, but I believe this is true as well. Like, you definitely have this dream of being a performer, and that's like the bigger
still
dream. Yeah. You're living it, Goldie. The TED show. Come on.
Yeah, you're excellent in that.
Yes.
Bring more of that. We want more of
you'll,
that.
You'll be coming back next season, I'm sure. So I wonder, is that a thing of like, is it delusional? Is it just that we've been so preconditioned to look at actors and performers and kind of worship them and we don't think about the writing side of it? Because for me, I realized, and I've said this many times on here, it's like I wasn't a good stand-up. Like, I didn't have good energy. I didn't have a good onstage persona. I feel like...
Hang on a second, because you did have an era-appropriate sort of slacker thing
but that
at the time work. I
agree with that, but that was just a coincidence and luck of timing thing, because I would have had that slacker thing in any era of comedy, because that's just, you know, I'm a slacker. But I like Goldie, and seems like you, I just realized, oh, if you can do the writing part of it without this, you know, bringing people to a stand-up show. Did you ever do stand-up, Danny?
I mean, literally twice. Like, I took a class, and it wasn't even a real twice, because one was like, I took a class and it was like the end of the class, which is not remotely like a real, you know, that's like a false positive, you know?
Yeah, right.
But maybe the reason like you want to start as a performer is like, it's the only way you can have your material performed, right? Like, if you're a completely inexperienced writer, like, what are you supposed to do with a script or whatever? Whereas you're like, well, okay, if I can do improv or stand up, then my material is being performed. But I just knew I didn't have the like the, you know, the fire in my belly to be like, to go through all the really hard stuff. I don't think I will personally like the end result enough to get through that. But writing, I was like, yeah, I'm kind of willing to like eat shit for 10 years and then maybe get good at this. And I think I'll like that. And I think too now, like I really enjoy working with someone like Jimmy, who it's like, I can't do what he does, but I can help him do what he does even better. And so then it's like material. I'm like, if I was a stand-up, material I write wouldn't be on the Oscars, you know, but it's like with Jimmy, right. It's like he's hosting the Oscars. Maybe I can give him some great jokes to do. And then so that like elevates what I do. It elevates what he does. To me, that's like, that's a much more exciting situation.
I think that, and that's a very good point. And I've had a similar feeling about Family Guy, where, you know, people make runs at you when you're a writer working for X number of years, and they'll come at you and say, oh, well, will you develop this TV show? Oh, you got to get your own show. You know, you got to do this and you got to do that. After a certain amount of time, I think I had the same feeling you had, Danny, where it's just like, you know what? I might just be best at like providing jokes for the Seth MacFarlane empire. Like, that might just be the role that I'm born to play. So I think that's a good lesson, or it's a good thing to think about for writers. It's like, if you have these bigger dreams and like, I got to do this and I got to do that, or people are making you feel that way, sometimes you just have to stop and think like, am I in a great situation for me now? And does this situation fit, you know, what my abilities the best? And it sounds like for you, you know, on Kimmel, it's a good fit.
It is. And even beyond working with Jimmy, you know, the staff we have at the show, you know, we have like 200 people who work at the show. They're all really good at what they do. And so that's also really fun as a writer, where it's like, okay, I have an idea for a sketch and Jimmy approves it. And then all of a sudden it's like, I have like a great director and producer, and the props guys are running into my office being like, is this what you were thinking? And I'm like, how cool is that? I go, I couldn't do any of that. And so that really like puts me in a position where even my ideas are like so much better, because I just have this great, awesome group of people like helping me do that. And so, you know, whereas like a stand up, it's all on you, and, you know, there's only so much you can do alone. So yeah. I don't know. I've just always enjoyed the group dynamic and working with other writers, and like that for me is the fun part. And I think during COVID, even, you know, we all went remote, and we never stopped doing our show. You know, we were like still working from home and doing all that. And I remember my wife being like, you seem like very like sad about work all of a sudden. Uh-huh. And I went, I think it's because I'm not physically seeing people. Like, we're still like kind of making fun of each other, you know, in our writer's text chain and stuff like that. But the part, once it was removed, I realized, oh, the main part I like is like, oh, hey, someone wore like a dumb hat to work, and that's like the whole day. I go, like, that's really the good part about being a comedy writer. And
I think this is something that's
dumb hats
really hurt society, is the remote work, and that we're only just scratching the tip of how bad this is for people, to have that socialization removed and replaced by this facsimile that everyone thinks like it's the same thing, when it just isn't. And there's, you know, bad things about obviously going in, it's inconvenient, but like psychologically, I know when I've been on Zoom. I think it's contributed to almost like a mania, and that whenever we go back, I'm better. You know,
same.
It just is the regularity of these interactions, which people used to think were so annoying. It's like a water cooler. It's like, I don't want to run into this person. But if you don't do that for long enough, like, how are you a human being? You know,
it's
sad to me. And I think particularly for a comedy show, you know, it's death. And that's why I think the industry is having trouble with comedy right now, because you want to go pitch a comedy, you're not pitching it in person, so the people are not getting a sense of you. They're not really picking up on these nonverbal cues of your enthusiasm, or, you know, like, I used to have a much easier time selling things in the room, because I think it's like that stupid cliche of a handshake, or, you know, a look in the eye, or they could see
energy,
your passion, or whatever.
Well, when you came through that door with the boater hat and cane, you know, the show was basically sold.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that's why people are like, what's happening to comedy? I think a lot of it is disappearing because at the executive level, it's not being pitched in person. So no one can tell. And then they're just kind of like losing faith in it, because it's like watching something through a curtain.
Yeah, right. Yep. And I think it depends on your type of work. You know, like, my brother's a computer programmer, and when they went remote, he's like, oh, great, I never have to see anyone ever again. And he was just sitting in an office, not talking to anyone anyway. So he's like, he's so excited. But like for comedy, you know, and even our type of show, it's like, all right, like we start work at like 7 a.m. and at 4:30, like, we're going to be taping a show and we have no idea what's in it. It's like, it's kind of important for us to like be together and to have this sort of like, you know, manic energy for a few hours here while we're figuring out the show.
Hang on, like, you just said you start at 7.
Yeah, 7? Jesus Christ, do you really start at 7?
Well, by the way, this is I've met writers from other late night shows, and when they find out I work at Kimmel, they go, I have a question for you. I heard you guys start at 7 a.m. Like, this has become like a thing of legend. Like, Dan Cronin actually asked me, he's like, why do you do that? Like,
why?
I'd rather work late than start at 7. I'd rather have dinner.
That's so early.
Yeah, our schedule.
Well, the show's over by then.
I don't know why we do it. It's just kind of how, like, we've learned to do it, you know, but we, our show's kind of like working at a newspaper, it feels like. I mean, it's like we get up really early. We look at what's going on. We just kind of rush until we like publish, you know, quote unquote, at the show. And then it's gone. But yeah.
So what time is the taping?
Yes, Mike, next question.
Taping's 4:30 every day.
Same time. As...
And we have a writer's assistant named Nick, who gets up at like 3 a.m. and looks like at all the news sites and figuring out like what's going on that day.
I thought you were going to say he looks like hell.
Yeah. I think he's like 26 and he looks like an elderly woman now. Yeah. I feel like we've watched the life drain from his eyes.
You definitely have.
Yeah. So we get at 7 a.m. all our writers get this email. It's like, all right, here are the big stories. Here's what we might cover today. People are,
and you're in the office at
this
point?
That's my next question.
No, we're at home. We do a rehearsal at 11 a.m. where Jimmy kind of looks at everything. So that's really when we're like in the office is 11, and then we tape at 4:30. So on site, you know, it's not too bad, but we write for about 2 hours in the morning, jokes and bits and all kinds of stuff. And then Jimmy gets a document at 9 a.m. that's basically like 40 to 50 pages of stuff. And then he cuts that down to about like 3 to 5 pages of stuff. And that's kind of our like first salvo of material for the day. And so that I think has given me a thicker skin about material, because it's like every day starts with just like, you know, 95% of your material just getting thrown away like immediately. But that's just kind of how it is writing on a show.
But
like
does
ours,
he
you know?
Come in and say, hey, this royal family thing is going on, or, you know, Jeffrey Epstein hung himself, I want to talk about it. Right. Or does he ever sort of inform things or send an email the night before? And
mostly we kind of, you know, and we can kind of tell what the bigger stories are going to be, you know. Yeah. So we do a lot of that, I think, before he's even going for the day. But there are times, like, I mean, this man works a lot on this show. I mean, he's super, super involved. And you know, there are times like, you know, at 1 a.m, he'll send a big monologue chunk where he's like, I want to talk about this tomorrow. And it's the kind of thing that we couldn't even really generate for him, you know, when it's like really from his, you know, point of view. And then he'll send that to us, and then we'll pitch him some extra jokes on it and stuff like that. But yeah, it's kind of a two-way street.
God, it's the opposite of Kilborn.
Why? What way?
Kilborn would be like at noon, be like, what if Goldie and Gibby are saluting John Stockton's shorts as we hoist them like a flag? You know, like, and it'd be like, okay, that's the day. Good day, guys.
Sounds like fun, too.
One day I remember it was like, you know, 12:30, and he calls you in his office, and you're trying to encourage him to work, you know, like it should be the opposite, that he's like, what do you got? But you're kind of like, hey, I do have some things I would like to talk to you about. And he's like, I know what I'm going to do. And you're like, you go, okay, great. What is it? He goes, I'm going to call David Brenner on the air and ask him, is he dating Ty Babylonia? Like, what? This is just a magnetic poetry of names. Like, what are you talking about? But then sure enough, he did it, and like the world didn't blow apart, and you know, the show got the same ratings and people seemed fine with it.
That's so random. Yeah. Well, so Danny, it seems to me from reading extensively about you online that I don't know why that's funny, that you have been at the Jimmy Kimmel Show for the length of your career. You started as an intern, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And was that in college, coming right out of college? When was that?
My last semester of college, and I was, you know, like looking to like, I was like, okay, maybe I should try to get a job at a TV show. And just because I was a big fan of Jimmy from when I was a kid,
I had a
friend who was working at the show, and I went like, hey, can you like let me know if they're ever hiring interns? And he emailed me one day and said they are. And he was not really helpful beyond that. Like, he just said, like, he goes, there's some woman named Gina, I think her name was Gina Clayton at ABC, and she hires interns. And I went, wow. Okay. And there was no further information. So then I started trying to guess her email address. Like, I'm like, it's probably like Gina Clayton at like Disney.something.
Yeah.
And I just like, wow. I should look it up, because there's a chain where I just like tried 1,000 times, but one of them came back. And I was like, great.
Wow.
I'm impressed. Wow,
and this that probably didn't surprise you based on the amount of pre-production I did on your own podcast.
But then
I interviewed, I got this internship there, and then I worked there for like 3 months at the end of 2006, and at the beginning of 2007 they had this job opening for what we call a TV watcher at the show, and where there's just four people who sit in a room and they watch TV all
I've heard
day.
About this
yeah
I believe it's
so
real.
So how do they divide? Like, is there a rotation where you say, okay, this week I'm news and you're sports and you're dramas? Because I would kill myself 3 days in if it was like, you're the Fox News person. Or
yeah. It was very competitive who got what show. It was kind of like Game of Thrones a little bit, where it's like, and then like, if someone got fired, like their TiVo would get pilfered for like all the good like shows. And then of course the newest guy always had the shittiest shows, and then would like not, you know, not get hired or whatever. But it'd be a mix. You know, I watched like Dr. Phil every day for like 2 years, like just hoping something funny would happen that I could
did
like,
it?
Like every once in a while, you know, or like. And then some shit like that was like in the era where like Tila Tequila's reality show was like
God.
A gold mine for me, you know, and I was like really watching that. And
right.
it was a very stressful job. I mean, it was my first job in television. I wanted it to go well. And so, you know, people are like, oh, you guys are probably like smoking weed and sitting on beanbag chairs. And I was like, no, I'm very stressed all the time. I'm watching The View under duress, like hoping like, oh God, I hope Whoopi says something funny so I can keep my job another week, you know? But it was a great like entry-level creative job, sort of, you know, like I was kind of getting
like
in a way, getting material in the monologue.
Then passing it along for then a team to write? You know, you're kind of assembling a reel every day. Is that?
Yeah, like, and so you like assemble everything, and then that rehearsal we do at 11 with Jimmy, he looks at all the clips, and we have our staff is assembled there. So if something gets a big laugh from the staff, like, okay, that would be good for the show tonight. And then the writers go on and write jokes to that. And then we'd also like, if a writer had a bit where they were like, oh, we're doing a fake Today Show promo where you pull me a bunch of like footage of, you know, the anchors doing this and that or whatever. So I got to know them pretty well doing that job. And then so that kind of helped me parlay into like the writing department eventually when they had a writer's assistant job open.
Amazing.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, again, I keep thinking of the contrast of Kilbourne. Oh, tonight we're going to steep tea to Joe Beam. But so you again, and I think you answered this question. So you're the TV watcher. Did you say for, was it like 2 or 3 years?
Yeah,
you did that?
Yeah, about that. Yeah.
Wow.
And then there was this opening as a writer's assistant. And did you, was that like all the TV watchers are going for that kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah. That was definitely like a good position and, you know, a way for it. And not every TV watcher, I think, wanted to be a writer. But I had, at that point, I was like, okay, that's like a path I would love to do if possible. And so I talked to the legendary Steve O'Donnell, who is David Letterman's head writer for many years and famously invented the top 10 list. He was our head writer at that time. And so I just went to him and I was just like, hey, like, I would love to learn about writing. He was super cool and like talked to me and, you know, gave me some notes on some like material I had. And but I think that was enough to like put the bug in his ear. It's like, oh, yeah, maybe we should keep an eye on that kid for when we have a position open. So he wasn't even there when I got that job. But I think when he was like, he was leaving the show, he was like, oh, maybe that guy, like, just keep an eye out. So
Kimmel at that point had been on, what, 3 or 4 years? It came on in maybe 2003, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so it was the sort of party atmosphere was gone by then, right? Because I remember supposedly that first year I had a friend who worked on the show and I would go in the green room at the time where it was like, this is nuts. But that was, they had stopped doing that by then.
Yeah. I think I was there the first year. It was like a regular workplace. You know, I mean, it's never really fully a regular workplace, but it like seemed like, you know, like professional and people aren't like, you know, like throwing printers across the room and, you know, like drunk and on the air and stuff like that. It was like, you know,
was Cousin Sal there?
Cousin Sal was there. I know Cousin Sal very well. Yeah.
Did he play any pranks on you?
Yeah, like every day he'll play pranks where there's really no payoff to them, like except for me being sad, you know, like
that's a payoff.
Yeah, yeah. Like I remember he came in, he like this is when I was one of the co-head writers, but he came in to like ask me a question and he's looking at my desk and he goes, oh, did you get a new lamp? And I go, yeah. And he just picked up and he just smashed it right on my desk. And then he had like a vendetta against lamps. That was kind of like his bit. Like, and like if someone had a new lamp, he'd just break it. And I have no idea how many lamps our show has bought over the years in Cousin Sal's wake. But
that's amazing.
Yeah, he's
Goldie's
funny
still
because
laughing.
He's
it's funny now.
He's like the magic trick of Cousin Sal is that he's the biggest dick in the world and everyone loves him to death. Like I mean, everyone who Sal knows would take a bullet for Sal, even though he does nothing but torment everyone in his life.
Yeah, I met him. I'm a fan of his from the Bill Simmons podcast from the football picks, and I met him once at a party. He was very nice and very mellow. Like I was expecting him to punch me in the face or something. And then also he was like way smaller than I thought he would be, which is kind of interesting because you would go like, why is he not getting just killed?
I'll tell you the thing about Sal. He runs 5 times faster than you would expect he runs. He has his legs are short, and I think he gets a lot of rotations in when he runs. We had a reel at some point that was just Sal running in bits, and with the staff loves it. It's like a
Well, so okay, so you become a writer's assistant, and now how do your duties change? Like, are you now in a position where Are you compiling everybody's stuff, or are you also throwing your own stuff in, or both?
Yeah, I started throwing stuff in eventually. You know, I didn't want to like, you know, come in like too hot on that, you know. So
Smart.
I think I spent you know, probably like a year like just kind of going like, all right, like I want to be like the best writer's assistant I can be. And so for me, that was just being like super organized and trying to anticipate things that were coming up, so there weren't like a, oh, we should have thought of that 2 days ago, and you know, doing the best I could there. But yeah, but then, you know, Jimmy was open to like, you know, oh yeah, like, you know, you can pitch a joke here or there if you want or whatever. And he and then Molly McNierney and Gary Greenberg, who are the other, you know, department heads with me right now, were the two head writers at the time and were like really great to me and really like took me under their wing. And like, as I would pitch material, they'd give me notes. And so me, that was really where I felt like I learned how to write comedy, was being in that job and having the safety to be like, I have like some mentors here who are kind of like looking out for me and giving me notes, and it's okay to fail in this way because it's not a big public thing. I'm not being paid to be a writer, you know, so it was kind of, you know, it was like a kind of a warm up kind of thing, which was really great.
You seem very adult. Do you think that that had to do with your rise?
Done adulting. He's done adulting.
He's not done adulting. He's like, he's just been adulting the whole time. Like, do you think that helped in that atmosphere of a Cousin Sal and some of the other writers who I've heard about are kind of legendary in late night circles, that amidst the chaos, they need someone who is, you know, has the mentality of like, I can wake up at 5:30 every morning and I will be here and I will, you know, if someone smashes my lamp, I won't have a freak out. And is that part of it as well, too, that in this, you know, atmosphere of sort of frenzy, you can be calm?
Yeah, I mean, I'm aggressively boring, which I think has like done me well, you know, and I think like even being a head writer, I remember like a family member of mine was like, oh, well, you're one of the head writers. Like, are you the funniest writer? I'm like, not at all. Like, and I'm like, I'm happy about that. Like, because I feel like I kind of make sure the trains run on time. I'm like I'm like the team equipment manager, sort of making sure like everyone's got what they need. And I just kind of like, I feel like my job is to like be level headed, help other people score, you know, and it's like, if there's a writer who it's like, oh, you know what, if I like help them get this idea approved and on the air, like it's going to be awesome. So like, that's what I'm going to do. And I do still write myself, but I feel like that's kind of now secondary in what my job duty should be. And it's making sure like everyone's like, you know, sane and happy and healthy and getting great stuff on the air. And, you know, that's what I see my job as.
That's so important. Cool. And that goes back to what we were talking about earlier about knowing your role, knowing what you're best at, knowing what best helps the show be funny. And it sounds like you've discovered all those things. And there were a couple of things that you mentioned.
Well, I just want to say, when I've been in that role, I just want to score the most and get the acclaim of the people I hired. So I had the worst approach that you can have. And then when that didn't happen, I'd get angry at them. So it sounds like you're doing it better.
Well, and look, you know, I'd be lying if I said like I didn't love getting a great bit or a great joke on the air. And, you know, and like,
of course.
And you know, like, of course, that's a great feeling. And of course, it's like, you know, when I make like our room of writers laugh, like that feels great. This is like a group of like my friends
who are
experts. I respect all of them a lot, you know. And so it's like that for me is like one of the best laughs I can get, you know.
Yes.
But also, too, I feel like if I was like out shooting bits all day and trying to get my material on the air, then like all the writers are like, hey, I need you to look at that like script I sent you 2 days ago. And I can't be like, I'll get to it when my genius has been produced. You know, I kind of just need to be available at all times to everybody. So while I think a lot of people get into comedy because they're just like super funny, like I feel like I have enough comic ability, but I also have the ability to just like sit at a computer for 12 hours and like work on something until it's, you know, right. You know, and I think that's what has helped me in a managerial position, too.
Yeah,
that's so interesting. Wow. And I just want to go back to a couple things you said, because one of them I think is very important and it gets brought up from time to time on the podcast. But I think we can never say it enough. You talked about how when you got the writer's assistant position, and I asked you, okay, were you submitting bits? And you said, no, I didn't want to be too aggressive with that. I wanted to be the best writer's assistant I could be. And then, okay, after some time has passed, then now it's more acceptable. That is so important. And advice that I would have given myself, you know, at 24 on Saturday Night Live that I did not take, because I was like, I thought like, okay, I'm in now.
Yeah.
But that's
sort of like brief counterpoint to that I want to bring up, that which is, nothing lasts long enough now to think that it will be on the air in a year.
Yeah.
Right.
So I think that might inform that people just go, whatever, this plane is going down.
Yeah.
I might as well, you know, have a few drinks.
That's an interesting counterpoint, and you're right, but I also feel like
you are right in the abstract. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm just saying that, like, since we have started doing this and things are only 8 episodes and they never
for shorter
get
shows.
Renewed, I can understand why someone would come in and just be like, you know what, fuck it.
But people remember the attitude. And so, Goldie, the counterpoint to your counterpoint is that, yes, that show will go down. But then there's the next show that's going to be created by a lot of the same people that were in that room, and they're going to remember you and say, like, eh, I don't know.
They were counterpoint to your counterpoint of my counterpoint. There won't be more shows.
Oh, no. That's sad.
Well, you've hit the nuclear button there.
I feel like when you're good at your job, people want to help you do whatever it is you want to do. Right, and, I think it's popular to go like, well, kids today think they want to skip the line. And I guarantee every older person has said that for the last 2,000 years of humanity. You know, it's so I don't think it's a generational thing. But I think what's true always is if you connect with someone and they're cool and they work hard, you bond with that person. And, there are plenty of people who I've put in a good word for because I'd just be you kind of look like I did where you were you're new to this show. You're working really hard. You want to do well. You're not just here because your uncle is a VP at ABC and you just want to get a paycheck and a Kimmel sweatshirt, or, you know, you're not you don't think this is beneath you. You're just you're really excited to be here. You want to work hard. You want this to be your career. Those are the people I could know someone for a week and get that sense in them and be I will do anything I can to help this person. Yes. And then there are other people you meet where they're just I remember I met with a PA once who was oh, can I meet with you? I was sure. And they're well, I've been here a year. So you know, what are you guys going to do for me? And I was sorry. You know, and it's and I'd never forgot that person either, because it was just it was just the wrong attitude, you know,
just the wrong.
One of my happiest days of working was when I was filling a position for a writer's assistant PA on a pilot. And I was down to these two candidates, and this one woman had gone to Harvard and, you know, had all the credentials lined up. And the other one went to Fitchburg State and told a story about getting run over by a truck and then picking up her bicycle and then going to work. And then I just remember I said to her, today is your lucky day because my mom went to Fitchburg State.
Oh, my God.
And I really want to go for Fitchburg State over Harvard in this instance.
Yeah.
And she was a great hire, but you're right that you know, when someone, and you know, she was a great employee as well, and has now gone on to bigger things, but people want to help out a younger person with a good attitude for sure.
Totally.
100% of the time. I mean, so that's that doesn't cost anything. That requires no experience. Just having a good attitude is 90% of people wanting to help you. And then if on top of that they're they're really funny, or they're a good director, or whatever it is, that's kind of gravy, you know.
And you mentioned earlier, so you work with Molly McInerney and I forget the other,
Gary Greenberg, New York comic guy. He's very funny.
Funny. They're both
bald.
Ooh, bald. How about that?
He's the baldest guy I know.
I don't know who he is.
Well, there's a bald list in Hot. We all know each other.
Yes. But you talked about being taken under their wing when you were young. And Goldie, that immediately made me think, have we ever been taken under anyone's wing?
No.
That, what a glorious feeling that must be. Yeah. It's warm, it's feathered. We just never got anybody's wing.
No.
We had our own wing. So now you're a writer's assistant. And how do you make the big leap from writer's assistant to staff writer?
Yeah, so I, you know, I, kind of in the ways that were appropriate, I'd sort of I'd throw a joke in, you know, here and there. And so it got to the point where I think Jimmy started going I think this guy could write here at the show. And I think unbeknownst to me, he had sort of been the next time we have a spot open, maybe we'll, you know, put Danny in there. But then in that time probably just because I have low self-esteem, I'd been well, I'm never going to be a writer at this show. This is a big show and no one leaves. And, you know, so I kind of started trying to figure out, okay, what am I going to do? And, so I had a friend who worked at another late night show who was hey, they're hiring writers. And so I submitted a packet over there, got an interview and actually got a job offer at this other late night show. So I was super excited for that, thinking oh my God, this is my first Writers Guild job. This is great. And so I emailed Jimmy to put in my 2 weeks and told him I'll never forget everything you've done for me. And you know, it was really he means the world to me, and he has done so much for me even at that point. And then his response was if I can figure it out this weekend, will you stay here and write for me?
Oh, that's exciting.
I mean, that was
That's so special.
I remember that.
Everyone's
moment.
Fighting over me.
It's a bidding war.
Well, you know, and again, I mean, I'm a completely unknown quantity, really. I mean, I have no experience or whatever, but I mean, I think like Jimmy knew me enough to be like, hey, I think you could do this. And then I remember Molly, who I think was dating Jimmy at the time. They weren't married yet, but I remember Molly emailing me just an email, just said, "You're not going anywhere."
And
I remember,
that's so great.
That was wow. great. Like, I that's one of those like things I'll never forget. So then on Sunday, he like calls me. He's like, okay, hey, I figured it out. Like, you know, one of our writers had wanted to be a director. And so he was able to kind of like move wow. stuff around, which is great. So then I started as a writer, and it was like the most scared I've ever been in my entire fucking life. I mean, it was like, like the dog that caught the car and was like, oh shit. Like
now what I have to perform
now. I was terrified. And the job I did was I sat with Jimmy. There's a couple of writers who sit with Jimmy all day and take all the approved stuff and put together the big, like rough draft of the monologue. So that was my position. I was like with him. All wow. day. And like, that was also kind of the next step of like the learning, where it's like, I've not only my writing, but I'm watching him assemble everything. And yeah. I think like that is such a different process too. And you kind of start to go like, oh, even if a joke is great, it might not work in a monologue for 1,000 different reasons. And like, right. I like that was such a good education for me to get there too. And it's like, and now as we've done, you know, these award shows and stuff like that too. It's like, you know, sometimes like you could write a joke that kills every fucking time in the writer's room. That's just like, how can that not go in the show? And then it doesn't go in the Oscars, but it's like, you go, there's a reason why it didn't, like it stepped on this other thing we have to do. And it's like, it's right. not about just going out and reading the 30 funniest jokes. It's about like, we need to kind of make something. And our monologue is more narrative too. You know, it's like, a lot of people do, you know, some other shows just do like, here's the 2-line jokes. It's kind of the classic 2-liner right. thing. Ours is a little more like a cable news broadcast, where we're like, you know, introducing a topic and doing big jokes and little jokes and throwing the pictures and B-roll. And so ours is a little different. And so,
yeah,
that was great. Watching how Jimmy produces our show was super educational. I mean, I'm just in his office all day. So like everyone who comes into his office, I see basically like every meeting he has. And like, that was super educational. So that for me was like a really important period of time. I feel like I kind of learned everything I could learn about working at a talk show during those years.
Yeah. And so let's talk for a minute, because you brought it up about award shows, because Jimmy is certainly, you know, whether it's this year's Oscars, which we loved, I don't know if you heard us talk about it, but we really enjoyed it. But he's been doing a lot of this stuff for a while. And I'm curious, we can talk about the Emmys and the Oscars. I'm curious about the White House Correspondents' Dinner, because that, to me, it seems like every year that's kind of the funniest thing that people don't watch. Like they don't really know about it as a thing. It's not certainly not as high profile as the Emmys or Oscars, but it's always very funny. And I think it's a combination of you get funny people to host and you have it. It's a great crowd to skewer, you know, to roast. And so what was that experience like? What do you remember from that experience?
That was like, I think one of the first things like that I had done with Jimmy. But I, you know, for me, I feel like the fun thing about an award show that's different from the late night show is like the opportunities you have for comedy in the room. And so because of that, the White House Correspondents' Dinner is like such a different crowd, right? Yes. You know, and it's like, that not all those people are really celebrities, you know, like, right, and right. like maybe Donald Trump is sitting there and you can, I mean, it's a totally different game all of a sudden. Yeah. And then Obama was president at that time. So it's like, you can do jokes about Obama, like to Obama's face, you know, like that's awesome, you know? And so it also like adds like a weird kind of stress to it too. It's like a different kind of high wire act being like, oh, like maybe something weirdly bad could happen if this doesn't go well, or I insult the wrong person, or like, you know, like, I mean, I, you know, the people believe Donald Trump became president because of he was made fun of at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, you know. So
by Seth Meyers.
Yeah. Which I don't know if I put total stock in that, but, you know, that's like that's the kind of thing that can happen. So. So that I remember Jimmy being really nervous. I think that was the most high profile thing I think he had done at that time. That was in 2012.
Oh, wow.
But you know, he did great. And like, he's a very like, he's a shrewd television producer, which I think is something that makes him great at this type of thing. And every award show we've done, when we get started, he usually kind of has like a few overall thoughts that are going to direct the writers. And it's not just like, let's just write a bunch of funny stuff. Like I remember the first year he did the Emmys, or maybe the second time, but he went like, I've been to the Emmys a bunch now, and it's very boring at the Emmys. Like the audience sits there, it's 3 hours. It's just boring. So he's like, let's do something that's going to be like fun for the room. And so, you know, like we handed out food, which I know is like a bit of a trope for like award shows these days, but it was kind of like, we're like, I don't know, that'll make everyone happy if they have like a drink and a sandwich and like, let's do that, you know? And like, let's like, you know, just kind of mix it up where if the room is having fun, it's going to play well at home. Right. And then same, like the first year we did the Oscars too, we did this huge bit where we like hijacked a like a tour bus, like one of these like Hollywood tour buses.
Oh, and yeah, I remember that.
They had real people on it and brought them in and, you know, met the people. And that really came from Jimmy going like, the Oscars always seem so pre-planned. I want to do something that is like a roll of the dice that maybe will not go well. But he was like, let's do something that's like a risk on the Oscars. And that's where that idea came from. So, I, you know, he's
it's
really
so tough because I feel like, you know, all the shows I've worked on, the talk shows, there was always the thought like, let's go to the Grove and get real people. And then you do it. It's very hard. You learn very quickly why real people are not on TV.
Yes.
Because they're incredibly inarticulate and bizarre. And yeah. And sometimes like just scary.
Right.
Yes.
So was there any vetting at all for that?
Like a little bit. And it, like in hindsight, I can't believe we did that. Like I just, right. just for all like the risk factors, but like the Oscars is stressful enough, right?
Right. Cause I remember that going well.
Yeah.
As well as that bit can go. Cause people always think like this is going to be amazing and we'll get, and it's like you're not going to strike gold by finding like Bill Burr level like citizens who are just able to kind of reel off funny crap.
Yeah. And with something like that, like I think kind of our sweet spot we've gotten into with award shows is like, something can happen that's unpredictable, but we've prepared as much as we possibly can. So I remember like, we're like, okay, we're going to have these people come in. We have no idea who they are. We had a couple of producers like posing as the like star tours, like people, like employees on the bus who were then like, you know, chatting up the people, but then like texting us information about them. And they were like, oh, there's this couple. They just got engaged. Denzel Washington's their favorite actor. And we're like, Denzel's in the front row. This is all happening like during the telecast, which I get. I'm like, in hindsight,
we were just watching Hugh Jackman get naked and you guys.
They were actually doing stuff. Goldie was trying to shimmy between Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones to use the bathroom.
But by the way, like the Oscars, I feel like most things in show business are so much more disappointing than you think they're going to be, right? Yeah. It's like, wow, if I could go to a movie premiere, that would be the great. And then you get there, you're like, it's just a bunch of publicists, like, just like eating sliders and there's no, the celebrities don't go to the movie and it's, you know, whatever. But the Oscars feel different though. I don't know if you guys felt like that, but we.
No, we got
just another dick punch.
Even just this year, like Jimmy has this tiny little dressing room in this narrow hallway and we had all lined up because he was about to walk to the stage to do the show. And so it's like there's, you know, 20 writers all packed in. Now the hallway is even smaller, right? Because we're all in there. And then every celebrity who's presenting in the first like hour of the show is now walking by. And so it was like, I mean, you see 30 and the Oscars this year had a lot of presenters that did, you know, that thing where like the five previous winners came out.
Yeah.
And like Danny DeVito comes around the corner and we're all silent. We're looking at him and he's like, hey, what's up? You know, like everyone felt like they had to talk to us, you know, and you know, we're like, you're going to kill it, Danny. He's like, yeah, thanks. Whatever. You know, it's like, it was really like, you're waiting, you're like for the bathroom and you're like, oh yeah, like Ben Affleck just was in this bathroom. And like, I don't know. It's what your parents imagine Hollywood is like.
I'd better wait 5 minutes.
Yeah. So it's fun. But anyway, to go back to the tour bus thing, like that was something we didn't know how that was going to go. But leading up to that, you know, when you do an award show, they have like those like placards in the seats, like the big cardboard thing where you're like, okay, like Emma Stone is sitting here and Denzel's here. And all the writers, we were sitting there and we were writing jokes for like every single celebrity in those seats that Jimmy could say. And we wrote like hundreds and hundreds of jokes. And Jimmy didn't even say most of them, but he was like prepared with them, you know? And so, and then he was still riffing stuff too. But I think it's like when we do something that's risky, we really go, what's every possible thing we could do to like make this go well?
Right.
You know, and then even like if there's spots in an award show where we're like, oh, okay, Jimmy's going to be out after someone might win this award. So let's write a bunch of jokes in case they win the award and then he can go out and do it. And it's one that we've like worked on and we know everybody likes. And so it's, even on top of that, he does riff stuff and he does just, he gets loose and he comes up with funny stuff. But we just, we always try to have a base layer of preparation with everything we do.
I would love to see one year, if you do it again, him saying, you know, I really thought Leo DiCaprio was going to win that award. So here's
the jokes. Here's the jokes.
Three jokes we were going to do. If he won, which he didn't. But
yeah, sorry, Leo.
That definitely happens. There was one year we did the Emmys, the year that the People versus O.J. Simpson was, yeah. You know, won all those awards.
That was, so good. That was great.
It was great. And so we had written, we, you know, written thousands of jokes like we always do. And there's always one joke the writers love that we go, we probably shouldn't do that. But Jimmy goes, the writers, me and the writers really like it. I'm going to do it anyway. And that year it was because O.J. Simpson was in jail at the time for the, yeah. You know, the memorabilia thing.
Yeah. And they got him for the right
thing.
They
got him. Yeah. And so the People versus O.J. Simpson wins this award and Jimmy's about to walk out there and we're all looking at him like, you're going to do the joke, right? Oh, he's like, all right, yes. I'll do the joke.
Yes.
And the joke did not go well. And the writers, we were so delighted that he did it and it bombed right. or whatever. And the joke was, he goes, congratulations, the OJ, he gets an extra slice of bologna on his sandwich tonight or whatever. Did not really get a response, but I, like the loudest response was us 100 feet away, like stage that he did it, you know?
It's amazing that stuff like that doesn't get big. Like people decide to get uncomfortable about something. It's like, oh, you're the guy's a murderer. We all know it. And the show.
Well, he's at least a trophy thief of his own stuff.
Yeah. Right.
Yes.
Well, and that's a weird layer in award shows. Too is like, and I think we learned this after the first like time we did the Oscars is you're like, people are, even if they think a joke is funny, they're very aware they're on camera, like at all times.
Yes.
And they could be a meme or they could be whatever. And so we kind of figured out like, oh, if a joke is like maybe a little too mean, even if it's funny, people are going to be like, yeah, maybe stifling laughter because that could affect their next job. Like, you don't want to be seen like laughing your ass off at Christopher Nolan on national TV. And then like,
right.
He's going to remember that and not cast you in the next thing. So there is like a balance. Yeah.
Really?
That's
good
a good point. Well now, Danny, you've been very generous with your time and you congratulations on all of your success. It's really awesome to hear your story because you have so many of the elements that I think we try to like let aspiring writers know, like here are some of the things that are really going to help you along your way. And it seems like for you, attitude is kind of the main one. We didn't have time to talk about, and I'm sure Goldie's glad about it, Star Wars and Marvel, because I'm right there with you. So I'll just ask you quickly, give me your top three Star Wars movies in order.
Oh, in order. Well, I mean, like the original trilogy, right? I mean, that's the only answer to that question.
Incorrect.
Oh, really?
Rogue One is better than Return of the Jedi.
Really?
Yeah.
Rogue One is good. Look at Goldie right now. He's so mad.
He's sleeping.
I'll just say Phantom Menace, even though I've seen none of them. And I think Jar Jar Binks is the best. Yeah.
Goldie famously thinks Donald Trump was the best SNL host of all time. So that sort of fits with that. I think Rogue One is far better than Return of the Jedi.
It is good. It's tough because it's like, it's only good because you've loved the other movies for 40 years. And so it's a bit on a curve. I agree with it. It is great. Yeah.
Yeah. And what about Infinity War was one of my top five theater going movie experiences. I thought they hit a huge home run with those last two.
I totally agree. I think they're struggling to catch up. I think they will, but I think that was like okay, this is how nerdy I am. When I'm just bored, I will look up, there are videos on YouTube of the theater reactions for when Captain America
too.
Picks up Thor's hammer.
I watch the hell out of that shit too.
And I get goosebumps
Thor's arrival in Wakanda with, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That trio of Groot and Thor and Rocket. Oh my God. It's all so great. But Goldie, you lived through it. See, we talked about it for a minute.
Sounded like fucking idiots. like Thor's
Alex.
Hammer.
You mean like sound like Alex over here.
it's what grown-ups should be talking about.
Thor's hammer.
I wish that we could edit it for Goldie saying, you sound like a bunch of idiots, and then I could just go into, Danny Ricker, thank you so much.
You have my permission to do that.
No, but seriously, Danny, it was great meeting you and great getting to talk to you here today.
Yes. Goldie, thank you so
another
much.
Great guest booking. So Danny, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Yeah,
thank you guys. I love the show. I really do. And I'm really excited to talk to you guys. This was great. Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks.
Oh, God.
Danny, so nice, so cool, great attitude. I love his story. Goldie, good get.
Yeah, thanks, Goldie.
All right, we're done with the interview, so now it's time for a portion of the show that we like to call Top 5.
Top 5.
Oh, beautiful. And Goldie, this was your category this week, so get us kicked off.
Yeah, I believe the original way I said it was Top 5 songs you love but also kind of hate.
Oh, I thought it was the other way.
I wasn't clear whether I'd said top five songs you hate, but also kind of love.
Same thing.
I think it's pretty similar. Oh. So just whatever you think it was.
Okay. Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
fine.
Totally.
Yeah. It's not a test. You can fail, JC. Don't worry.
Yeah. number 5, James Blunt, You're Beautiful.
Oh. Wait, do you love it?
Terrible, right?
Yes.
It's I don't know.
It's good, though. It's good at the same time. You can't get it out of your head.
Number 4, I think I'd waited 25 years for this. Hated it. And then it was okay. Guns N' Roses' Chinese Democracy.
Oh. Yeah.
And then finally came out.
Hadn't thought of that.
Number 3, Skater Boy.
No. Wow. Oh. Avril?
I think I like it, but it's terrible.
That's funny.
Number 2.
Yeah.
A song I enjoy. It's awful. She Bangs.
She Bangs. Wow.
William Hung.
Yeah.
Just, bangs, bangs.
It stinks, but I don't know. It's great.
Yeah.
That's funny.
And number 1, and to me, this is the undisputed heavyweight king, Mariah Carey, All I Want for Christmas Is You.
Oh, but I love
I just
that
straight
song.
Like it. I just straight like it.
Okay.
Wow. Okay.
List, though. I love thinking of that. Okay, here we go. Number 5 for me, song that I know is bad, but I love it, Sue Studio.
Oh, I love that song.
Love it.
I don't know what it is.
Me neither.
I don't think it means anything. I think I read that it's not a reference to anything specific, which makes the song even worse slash better.
Yeah, it's not her name.
No. Number 4, Party All the Time by Eddie Murphy.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's a perfect one.
Wants to party all the time. Stuck in my head. And number 3, immortalized on this podcast, We Built This City.
Ooh,
we
built
this I think that's city. A good song.
I
think it's straight good too, but I had to put it on here.
Nice.
Number 2, a song called Let Her Cry by Hootie and the Blowfish.
I don't even know that
Let
song.
Her cry and a tear pour down like rain. Well, that's okay. Our friend Scott Holroyd will know that one.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
And number 1, With a Bullet. Because I'm a scat man. Beep, ba, 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 da, boop.
What is that? Beep, ba, ba, da, boop. I don't know that song.
Yeah, it's called Scat Man, parentheses, be ba 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 da bo. It really is called that.
Bye. Who's a bye?
I have no idea.
Okay, awesome. Great list on both sides. I don't know. I think you're not going to know a couple of these songs, but this is my list.
Okay.
One, sure. 2, 3. Okay. My number 5, you will know, is dun 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 dun. The Danger Zone by Kenny Loggins.
I think that's just good.
That's
good.
Oh
wow. Okay. Number 4, Opposites Attract by Paula Abdul.
Oh, that's
just bad.
I know, but for some reason I love it.
Take 2 steps forward. Take 2 steps back.
I don't know. I listened to it. I was like, oh, but I love
this. Very funny Family Guy cutaway uses that song.
Oh, wait.
Where Peter says, because I'm just like a cat. Because remember, it was with MC Scat Cat, the rapper.
Right,
he did
right.
With Paula. Yeah.
Okay, these two you may not know, even my number 1, but my number 3 is by Lil Nas X and Jack Harlow. It's called Industry Baby. So I took this list as songs that I hate but also love.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So if you know the song, you might agree.
Okay.
Number 2 is by Post Malone, which is a song called Circles. Again.
Cycles.
It's like, it's a song I hate, but I actually love.
All right. Good.
And my number 1 is by Avicii, called Wake Me Up. It was a huge song.
Yeah. Yeah. Wake me up. Get them up inside. That one?
No. Now I can't remember how it goes. Darn it. What?
Wake me up.
Yes, I don't want to sing that. But yes, it's that one that Stu was singing.
Stu was singing it. What song am I thinking of? Because that's also a bad song that I kind of like.
Wait, sing it again.
You know, it's on Wake Me Up. Don't wake up and I can't wake up. Save me.
Oh. I don't recognize it at all.
Was I just rambling like an Alec there? No,
but it was fun.
I hope that doesn't exist.
If not, we'll record it. We will
I'm
record it.
I'm sending it to both of you today.
Yeah, we should record it.
Wake me up.
We should write what we think inside. It is.
Yes, we have to do that.
All right, so that was very fun today. And JC, is this? It's yours next week.
Yes, next week.
What do we got?
Top five things that gross you out.
Oh, good one.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Gross.
Suckerose.
Hey, before we... move on, and I know we're done for the week. I just want to say something to an emailer received something from, a friend of the show.
Yes.
His name is Robert Spiker, out of Austin, Texas. And I just want to say to Robert, dude, you're fine.
Yeah.
He'll know why.
He'll know what it means.
Yes, he does.
Go get
he
him, will. Robert, because you are fine.
Yes, thanks for
that
your
was
email.
A fun show today. Danny Ricker was great.
Awesome.
Hey, and by the way, we're not doing a high note this week, and we have Tom Gamble here to tell you.
No!
I don't know if we'll do that again. That was a little long. That was even longer than the high note. Kind of wavered at the end.
It's 11 and a half seconds.
Oh, my Lord. That we'll never get back. But, Tom, we had a lot of people reaching out to us about how funny you were last week. So that was great having you back, you and Morty.
And, and please go see his play, Mornings, with Ernie Bushmiller.
Whoa. That's not when you usually see a play. Anyway, thank you, Danny Ricker. Thank you all for listening. Yeah. Thank you two for being awesome.
Thank you.
And we will talk to you again next week.
Next week?
That was fun.
And it stops right now.
Wake me up. Don't wake up, Vince. I can't wake up. Save me.
Dude, you're fine.